Well, if you'd like to open your Bibles there at 2 Corinthians chapter 12, and especially we're looking at verse 7 and the thorn in the flesh. For the title of what I'm speaking on this evening is Grace in Affliction. Paul speaks there, doesn't he, of God's grace being sufficient for him in the midst of that particular trial that we'll look at in a moment, that he was experiencing, and that he shares his heart, opens his heart there to the Corinthian church to speak to them about his condition. This particular consideration was very much prompted by my own health condition, which I know many of you here who have known me over the years have known that I battled with for quite a few years. And the Lord was very pleased with a brain surgery last year to bring me through that particular situation. I remember actually last year this time I had a whole row of tablets I was lining up there to have to take to get me through the meeting. Well, no tablets there on view tonight. The Lord was very good to me. But we all of us, don't we, have afflictions, different kinds of trials. John Newton's hymn that we just sang about there very much expresses the sort of territory that we are in this evening. So, grace in affliction. And first of all, we'll do some exegesis on this interesting incident that Paul speaks about there in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I have a heading, first of all, thorn in the flesh. Thorn in the flesh. What was the situation that Paul had encountered and which he was so keen to be rid of? Because the trouble had obviously been very severe. Paul tells us, concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. We note there in verse 8. Three times. This was not something then that he was affected by that was light and superficial. It was obviously a serious problem for the apostle. But what is the thing that is referred to? Well, he describes it, doesn't he, to his readers, as a thorn in the flesh and as the messenger of Satan in verse 7. There are two descriptions then, which convey something of the sense of what it felt like to the apostle, without actually saying precisely what it was. There is a simile, like a thorn in the flesh. In other words, it was something like a thorn in the flesh. It's a likeness, a similarity that he is establishing, using an everyday situation to convey something of that felt reality. Perhaps those of us who do a bit of gardening there or tangle with a rose bush will know what it's like when you get a thorn there lodged in your finger. And then there is the term the messenger of Satan. But again, the identity of that messenger is not revealed to us by Paul here. He refers to the cause of his trouble again obliquely in verse 8, but simply with the Greek word this. That's there we see in verse 8. And the translators have helpfully added to this the word thing. This thing. Paul does not elaborate more, because the fact is that the main point of this particular section of his second letter to the Corinthians does not hinge on the precise identity of this thorn in the flesh or messenger. You see, we have to be honest to the context. Paul is writing about this incident for a particular reason. It's not central to his purpose to identify what this thing was that was causing him difficulty. More important for his purpose is countering the version of divine approval and authentication that was being circulated by the false apostles in Corinth, who were busy undermining Paul's authority and burnishing their own credentials as credible, gifted, and spiritual leaders. These men were claiming divine authority and power, and were grounding their appeal in their great accomplishments and revelations. And that has a very contemporary feel to it, doesn't it? And we can, I'm sure, name the names of those who make their boasts in their great visions and revelations. Paul, you see here, is commenting on their habit of self-promotion. So, for instance, just in an earlier chapter, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 12 to 13, and also verses 17 to 18, we read this. Paul writes, "For we dare not make ourselves of the number, or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves, and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise." He goes on, "But he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. For not he that commendeth himself is approved, but whom the Lord commendeth." Unlike the false apostles who boasted about the things that made them look impressive, Paul instead boasts, inverted commas, about the things that make him look very unimpressive. All the beatings, shipwrecks, dangers, and deprivations, that list that we read there at the latter part of 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And he rounds off that list of trials in chapter 11 in verse 30 with this: "If I must needs glory, I will glory of the things which concern mine infirmities." So the thorn in the flesh incident becomes a further piece of supporting evidence that the Lord does not back boastful, got it all together, supremely cool and successful individuals. No. The Lord works through weakness, through weakened people in their struggles and trials, and through a host of frowning providences. The Lord keeps his servants in check and humbles them. He sends them thorns in the flesh, not celebration bouquets of roses. His strength is made perfect in weakness, verse 9. God's method is to communicate his gospel, his character, his ways, through hindered, battling, greatly exercised individuals. The precise identity of the thorn in the flesh is not actually relevant. Indeed, reviewing the whole section, including this about the thorn in the flesh, Paul concludes this in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 12. "Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. When I am weak, then am I strong." So in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, there is no person that is named, nor group of people, nor a specific condition. But if Paul is not giving us a precise identity, the effect of the thorn is, however, fairly obvious. It rendered the great apostle weak. That is how it affected him. The word, which we have here, the Greek word asthenia, refers to being strengthless or suffering some infirmity. Now, this is perhaps a clue as to the nature of the affliction. We are in good company if we reckon it was a physical impairment, rather than something by way, for example, of overt persecution by someone. It looks more likely Paul is referring obliquely to a physical complaint or malady that was impairing his ability to do the work the Lord had called him to do. Paul, we remember, is the man who said in a previous communication to this church in Corinth these words, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 16, "For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of. For necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel." That is what the gospel work meant to him. From this, it is very easy to understand why Paul prayed with such urgency for deliverance from this weakening and hindering condition. He desired to preach the gospel so intensely that to be prevented from it led him to perhaps express his desire three times to be delivered. So we're tracing our steps a little. What we're seeing here, can we get a little nearer to specify what the precise nature of the hindrance might have been? Well, in a sense, we can only speculate, but many think it runs like this. Paul had referred to an illness that had caused him to remain amongst the churches in Galatia. When he writes his letter to the Galatians, there in chapter 4 and verses 13 to 14, he says this. You know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first. My temptation which was in my flesh ye despised not, nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. It is possible that in this passage, this letter to the Galatians, we're hearing Paul describe the infirmity that he is speaking of to the Corinthians. Going back to Galatians chapter 4, verse 15, what does he say there? He says this, what is then the blessedness ye spake of? For I bear you record that if it had been possible, ye would have plucked out your own eyes and have given them to me. His reference to their giving him their own eyes, if they could, gives us a strong hint that it might have been some eye condition that had stopped Paul travelling on and had detained him in the province of Galatia. So from this, though admittedly it is still no more than informed speculation, we have some basis for supposing that this eye condition might have flared up again and halted Paul in his tracks, this occasion maybe preventing him from being able to minister at all. The weakening effect produced by the thorn in the flesh that Paul refers to in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 9 fits in with the effect of a physical infirmity along the lines, perhaps, of the condition that detained him in Galatia. Now my next heading, putting the record straight. It's only fair to point out that others have come to an alternative position and are drawn by the idea of the messenger of Satan, which we have there in verse 7, of course. And they reckon, therefore, that the hindrance to Paul was an actual person, a messenger. By way of further exegesis, we'll want to turn to the Old Testament and look at some of the warnings there for disobedience. Obstructed people are often described as thorns. For example, Moses, writing in Numbers chapter 33 and verse 55. What does he say to the people? He says this, "But if ye will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell." Numbers 33, verse 55. Well, the warning there is clear. Future disobedience on the part of the Lord's people will mean hindrances and obstructions set in their way, spoiling their peaceful enjoyment of the land the Lord was giving to them. The Lord warned his people their troubles would come from the pagan people whom they had failed to dislodge. Other people, then, will be the thorns in their side. And there's some similar references along these lines in Joshua chapter 23, verses 11 to 13, and in Judges chapter 2, and in verses 2 to 3. But these Old Testament impediments and restrictions were designed to punish the people for their disobedience. And that is not the situation with Paul. He is not being punished for disobedience. For indeed, he explains why God sends the trouble upon him. In verse 7, "Lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure." You remember, don't you, earlier he had described how he was caught up to the third heaven in verse 2 and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Verse 4. So it appears that the thorn in the flesh was a check to Paul's enjoyment of these revelations and a curb to any inflated sense of self-importance that might follow. Old Testament references, however strong the pull, we feel to identify thorns in the side as actual people from the usage there, we would, I think, in this instance, be wise to partially uncouple the idea of the thorn in the flesh from its immediate Old Testament context. In other words, we uncouple it from the reference to the cause, namely disobedience, and retain instead, and major on, its linkage to the effect, namely the loss of comfort and peace. That way we honour both the Old Testament context of thorns in the flesh and the explicit explanation that Paul provides for us in 2 Corinthians in chapter 12. But before we leave this more exegetical part, there is a word we might also look at that is deeply suggestive. And it's the word in verse 7 rendered buffet, to buffet. It comes from the Greek word kolophizo and implies being struck by a clenched fist. It's a blow to the body or to the head that has the effect of concentrating the mind and completely distracting you from the task at hand. So again, we can imagine Paul facing some illness that is overwhelming and that simply cannot be ignored and which puts everything out of joint, all his plans, all the work he had hoped to achieve. So this then, by way of exegesis. Now we move on. What are the lessons that we can learn? Paul's affliction may not be caused by quite the same sets of reasons as the trials and afflictions, buffetings that we may encounter. Yet, they have the same capacity to knock us off course. How then are we to reflect upon our situation? And what, when God promises sufficient grace for Paul, might we expect to find in our particular trials? So my next heading is this, ups and downs, ups and downs. One key distinction that we could make is to identify those situations which are peculiar to us as Christians and those which come to us because we are part and parcel of the human race. There are lots of afflictions, incidents or conditions that believers and non-believers alike face. The sun shines and the rain falls on both camps. Is there anything, for instance, that comes by way of weather is indiscriminate. Christians' homes get flooded, as do those belonging to non-Christians. High winds topple down trees on the properties of blasphemers and lovers of God. Droughts wreck the harvests of the godly and the ungodly. Or take machinery and equipment. Think not that only your computer developed some malevolent virus moments before you need to print off some vital piece of work or coursework or something of that nature. Yesterday, maybe, it was a radical Muslim whose car would not start due to a flat battery. But today, it was our car that wouldn't start. There's nothing remarkable in this. Computers crash, trains are delayed, flights are cancelled, appointments are missed due to malfunctioning cars, and this is so for all humanity, Christians and non-Christians alike. What then of our health? Well, sicknesses come in equal measure to Christians and non-Christians alike. Spots break out. Children come out in bright red rashes. Elderly people get water infections, and this is so for Christians and non-Christians. Sicknesses are in that way indiscriminate. They affect the bodies and minds of Christians and non-Christians. The same goes for various conditions we can mention. Chronic conditions, untreatable conditions. These are the lot of all humanity. The same goes for accidents. Christians can sometimes think that only they have these kinds of things happen to them. But a trip to the local hospital or the doctor's surgery should dispel that notion quickly. The same is true of illness and disease. Christians are not especially singled out when it comes to health conditions or the incidence of disease and infection. These things come to the families of Christians and non-Christians alike. Paul called his thorn in the flesh a messenger of Satan. And indeed, the devil does try to employ our trials to put negative thoughts in our minds, such as to make us doubt, maybe, our spiritual state. If I am a Christian, why does my computer always break down or my car never start? We can sometimes put it in that way. So grace is especially given to us to counter these suggestions and these ideas that can come and begin to make us question our spiritual state. But church history tells us that some of the choicest saints have endured painful conditions that are the lot of all mankind. I think the great C.H. Spurgeon comes into mind in that category. But what are we to think about these kinds of situations? Things that we have to put up with, experience, along with non-Christians. What grace is given to us? How do we deal with these situations? Do we panic? Or do we grumble? Or emit some unbelieving nonsense that this would happen to me? Do we cope better or worse than the world does in dealing with these kinds of issues? After all, it's the same for everyone else. Herein is the challenge. How do we, as people who have the Lord with us and for us, come through these everyday matters? Do we present something different as Christians to the unbelieving world? Or are we worse than unbelievers? More bad-tempered? More angry and complaining? More ready to argue and find someone or something to blame? Do we meet adverse circumstances with faith, hope, and courage? Ideally, non-Christians should be able to detect something special, because we have a well-grounded hope of eternal life. We have God for us and promising to be with us at every point. It should show in how we live our lives in this fallen world where accidents will happen, calamities will befall us, those we love, and where death is still, barring the imminent return of Christ, going to be something each of us in turn is going to have to face. The promise to Paul was, "My grace is sufficient for thee." We are to believe this. The thought, indeed, is to master us precisely when things are going awry. So whatever the nature of our trial, we should respond with faith. Faith, the gaze that looks to the Lord who loved us and gave himself for us. The trust that believes that all things are in his hand, all are foreseen, and believes, therefore, that wisdom, help, encouragement, moral transformation, power, courage, boldness, knowledge, in other words, grace, is available to us. Even the smallest inconveniences are opportunities for us as Christians to grow, to be taught, to think differently, to react differently, to build character, or to do something that will bring glory to God. Now, sometimes it can be very evident to us why the Lord may be bringing to us a particular trouble. The Lord might bring a challenge in an area of known weakness and difficulty. We might have had a comfortable ride, and it is time to toughen up. Toughen up some more. Trials and afflictions may have something striking and very personal about them. Something that takes us back to a point in our lives where we failed previously and where now we are invited to seek the Lord's help and improve on our past performance. The variety of lessons and the grace that accompanies these is really quite endless. Well, that's the ups and downs of Christians and non-Christians alike. Now, sometimes God may highlight, as it were, through some of those inconveniences, areas where we need to develop patience or faith. But then, of course, and this is my next heading, there are Christian troubles. Troubles for the believer. Hardships and troubles that are the special lot of Christians. Here we may think of persecution or trial as an alternative word to affliction. These are more man-made troubles, devil-inspired trials, things like persecution, where Christians, none other, are the object of attack, discrimination, ridicule, legal action, and often false accusation. These may arise because of the gracious and standout behaviour that Christians show, or should show. Our conduct should, and often does, attract attention because it is different to how the unbeliever behaves. People often may be very happy to have trustworthy, reliable, honest, hard-working people as part of their organisation, workplace or school. Employers do not usually grumble if their employees turn up on time, work hard, do not steal from the company, and are obliging and friendly. Teachers do not normally grumble that children are so well behaved and conscientious. But those with less of a stake in the success of the organisation or institution may not see it the same way. Those on the shop floor, or in the classroom, or at the desk next door, may not be so impressed. Our behaviour is, in fact, a standing rebuke to them. Their attitudes may be slovenly, lacklustre. They may be stealing from the company, fiddling their expenses, exaggerating their output, or engaged in some morally dubious enterprise. The last thing they want is for their sin being reproved by someone whose standards are totally out of sympathy with their own. So for these and many other reasons, we are open as Christians to being attacked verbally, physically, emotionally, and in a host of other ways. That's before we've even opened our mouths. So then, of course, there is the persecution and affliction which follows as a result of our spoken testimony. Maybe we explained the way of the gospel, or gave a tract or a Bible to do the talking for us. We might have given a booklet explaining six-day creation, or given a calm, reasoned defence of traditional marriage. Open-air preaching, and Christians operating their businesses according to their Christian moral convictions, have all had difficulties thrust upon them. This is trouble. It comes particularly to the Christian because we are Christians. And these troubles and trials and afflictions come in various packages. And in a way, we can understand these that are honed in on us as Christians better than those that are more indiscriminate and which non-Christians and Christians alike face. We can understand the sinful world that we are in reacting in the way that it does to our Christian standards and our Christian testimony. So Peter, for instance, in his first letter, remarks about the lust, lewdness, drunkenness that was part of the Christian's pre-conversion life. And he comments on the world's reaction in chapter 4 and verse 4 when he says this, "Wherein they," that is the world, "think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you." Well, that's all to be expected, isn't it? And in many ways, we can understand these sorts of behaviours and reactions, troubles that we get, rather than the other frowning providences, health conditions, whatever, that may assail us. If we are the person suffering loss and hardship, stress or pain, because we are Christians, well, there is grace. We the source of trouble, a family member, a neighbour, a work colleague, your trials are known to the Lord. This is the path the Lord himself had to walk, and he accompanies us in it. We have the consolation of knowing the Lord's especial provision and mercy. They're not, for instance, unkind or glib words that Peter speaks. Again in 1 Peter chapter 4, and here in verses 12 to 13, let me read. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice, inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. Grace, then, is given in order for us to gain a biblical perspective. It's given so that we can live out what we read here, for instance, in 1 Peter, as we find elsewhere in the Bible, in our day-to-day living. Well, now my next heading. Grace in all its variety. Grace in all its variety. When the Lord promised to Paul that his grace would be sufficient for him, he promised good to his servant. Grace, which we were thinking of here, as the action of God toward his people, especially in regard to work that he will do in our soul, covers virtually everything, in a sense, that the Lord might do for us and in us. For one of the things he brings to us, as we've just been thinking about there, is knowledge and understanding. Afflictions are intended for our good. So we always have an expectation of our sufferings, our afflictions, leading somewhere. We are to believe that we are going to finish ahead, not behind, despite the feeling that we might have been delayed, slowed down, or hindered. In the end, we are to say this: there will be not loss, only gain. That is what sufficient grace will ensure happens. So we need to be alert to all the possible ways that the Lord might be dealing with us as we endure an affliction. It is a time for heightened spiritual discernment and sensitivity, and not a time to go absent without leave. This is why it's important to pray during afflictions and trials. Paul did, prayed three times, didn't he? And so must we pray. By prayer, we may well be meaning something less than we would usually be capable of in times of good health and stability. Carefully ordered thoughts or logical progress in our petitions might have to take a second place. For my own situation, I had this particular pain in the face. It was sometimes very hard to be able to concentrate, knowing that suddenly I was about to be convulsed with something akin to an electric shock through my face at any given moment. And it wasn't always easy to string together coherent thoughts when you knew that you would suddenly get a pulse of pain ripping through your face in that way. Well, many of us may be familiar with that or other situations that are akin to that. And it can be grueling, and it can be exhausting. But it's important to stay in an attitude of prayer. We remember, even if our thoughts are not as coherent and logical as we would wish them to be, we are never out of the presence of God, even if we're not functioning fully with all our faculties and with a clear mind. He is with us in the pain and the interior mental world that intense pain sometimes pushes us back into. Because we're not covering, maybe, the range of thought we normally would in our prayers, it doesn't mean that we're not praying. God reads our hearts better than we do ourselves. Our sighs and groans, our longings, our tears, our utterances, our cries are all registered. If they were not coherent to our way of thinking, Christ's intercession perfects them and makes them more intelligible than we could have made them at the height of the exercise of our powers. In my situation, it was good at times just to sit and meditate before the Lord, to have my soul directed to him, even if there are not words capable of being said. It was good for me to have been in the Lord's presence. So to have that capacity, to be able to reflect upon that, is actually a sign of grace at work. To sigh is a sign of grace in the heart. After all, nobody has set the limits as to what kind of prayer is admissible or qualifies. Your prayers, even those sighs and longings, when you can't string together the words that you will, are all signs of life and of hope. They show us that you and I are being sustained from heaven. It may not look or sound pretty, but your Father knows better. Be encouraged. Remember this too. He is not shocked by us in our weakened state, nor is he only interested in us when we are on what we might call active service. We've not become a disappointment to him because we're not able to lead the meeting we usually would or do the jobs for others we normally would do. One occasion I can remember being laid out flat on my bed, as that was the only place to find any relief. You may well know that in conditions that you have as well. But there, it was wonderful to ponder, as I lay there, rendered out of service, to know that I was loved of God, even if I never preached another sermon or visited anybody in my pastoral capacity. Why, if I never rose from that position again, I was still sure of my place in my Father's house above. And that was a good check to the soul, that I really did believe that it was salvation by grace alone, through faith alone. Absolute reliance on Christ's work on the cross is the key. These afflictions can sometimes be used of God to bring us to admit the reality of what we know in our hearts, but which we sometimes have to confess when we're not capable of any tangible works, at least as we might conceive of them. Furthermore, there is grace given to us in the thought that other people are praying for us. And even if we are not capable of stringing together coherent words in prayer, we might be struggling and feel desperately disappointed in ourselves. And yet, it's immensely comforting to know, and for me personally, a delight to think, that the Lord will hear the prayers of others on my behalf and on your behalf. So, grace in all its variety. Now we look at grace in deliverance. Grace in deliverance. You see, perhaps, as with my situation, in our afflictions, it's merely a waiting period until the Lord shows some exceptional kindness to encourage you, and perhaps through you to encourage others too. Trials may have a limited time span and then be done with, and we are unable to move on greatly encouraged. That is why we're to be vigilant in our afflictions. We can, you see, I think, sometimes second guess God and get it wrong. For instance, we know that we deserve nothing but wrath from God given our sins. We know that as saints, we have squandered much light, many opportunities, and spurned many kindnesses that God has shown us. And it's shaming, isn't it, to think about them. From this, we can only too well imagine that it will be our just deserts to have to stop with the trial and affliction, why, till our dying day. We're slow to learn and ungrateful, and we can have no ground to complain if the Lord kept us permanently under the yoke, so unholy and so worldly that we are. Why, yes, we can imagine that we'll always need stern discipline and affliction. And so we can imagine that the Lord is totally justified in maintaining us in this state for time immemorial. But is it not so in keeping with the character of God to be generous to the undeserving and to send the grace of deliverance? fancy intends it for you, as I think he also intended it for me. We should not grow so familiar with our afflictions to think that we must remain detained at his majesty's pleasure forevermore. We might have to be ready to change tack, to, like Joseph, put off our prison clothes, prepared for something different and quite unexpected. So whatever our affliction and present difficulty, the Lord may be waiting to show some especial favour to you. Now my next heading, grace to do evangelism. Grace to do evangelism. When we have afflictions or various trials, we should always aim to bring honour to the Lord. That includes the desire to continue to be witnesses. Sometimes that, of course, will be impossible. Why, we might have been struck unconscious, or be rather embarrassingly non-compos mentis. We might be unable to speak, as was sometimes the case with me. So we may not always be capable of saying anything. And there are times, too, when we might not feel like saying anything. We simply do not know what to say. We might have been brought very low. Steep challenges to our faith. Be not quite able to trust ourselves to open our mouths. So there are plenty of provisos. But we must not look for too many excuses or ways out either. Paul was still serviceable, even under the pressure of his affliction. For him, the promise of sufficient grace was for right there, right then. It might not have been gospel ministry that was of the regular kind, no pulpit, no public meetings perhaps. But instead, there might have been some fresh and utterly novel situations where he could witness that presented themselves for him. And it might be the same for us. For example, do not look on doctors and nursing staff as a nuisance, or as if they are deliberately there to spoil your day, interfere with you, cause you trouble. We should look to adorn the gospel in how we speak to people in the medical profession. We should look to move beyond our particular concern or need and maybe think of theirs. What sort of a day are they having? What are the pressures that they are working under? What is the home life that they have come from in order to begin their shift there on the ward? So ask questions. Show them that you actually care about them, that you appreciate them, which I hope we genuinely do. Pray for opportunities to share some gospel truth with people that we might meet in the medical profession. You see, kind people from the caring professions often, when we are needy and vulnerable, ask us questions. Who are we? What do we do? What are our interests? Well, we should seek to say something helpful about the Lord, what he means to us, what the direction of our life is, and especially if we're facing death, what then? Perhaps we'll be able, with God's grace, to surprise people with how we deal with the prospect of death. Does it hold the same terror for us as for other non-Christian people who might have passed by that way? So we should look to say something about eternity. So there to show to the doctors, to the nurses, whoever we might meet, just where our treasure actually is. Grace, another heading, the death of pride. Grace, the death of pride, and that came through, didn't it, in the hymn we sang earlier then of Newton's. God's promise is that he'll be with us in our afflictions, and that promise also means the death of sin. Grace, in the midst of suffering, helps to promote holiness and bring destruction to its opposite, sin. Paul's affliction was designed to stop him becoming proud, given the revelations he'd received, so that instead it might be evident that whatever is happening in him, it's the Lord's strength being made perfect in weakness. Something similar may be happening to us. So, for instance, here, 1 Peter chapter 4, and verses 1 to 2. What we read? We read this. For as much then as Christ hath suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind. For he that hath suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lusts of men, but to the will of God. John Calvin comments this well. He's on 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. Listen to what he says. Whatever the infirmity is under which we labour, let us bear in mind that we are, as it were, buffeted by the Lord, with the intent of making us ashamed, and in this way of teaching us humility. Those who are mature in the faith, whose lives display much spiritual fruit, should be especially careful to reflect on this if they are persecuted by those who hate and revile them. These things are not merely rods of the heavenly master, but buffetings, intended to humble them and beat down all presumption and pride. It's painful, isn't it, to hear it? But it's necessary. We're all of us given to pride, arrogance and self-sufficiency, stubbornness and vanity. Troubles come to lessen our love for ourselves. We find out what we're made of, and it can be very humbling. Grace is given to be sensitive to the Lord's dealings and to respond with faith and obedience. Repentance is never more in evidence than at such times. That's why Peter, in that verses I just read a moment ago, is able to say that those who have suffered in the flesh have ceased from sin. Something has been burned out. Some self-love, some self-conceit, some self-reliance dies. And so God opposes pride in us at every turn, using afflictions and trials to achieve the end of our sanctification. Pride, you see, is the loser. And not the only one either when the Lord deals with us in affliction. There are a host of issues to do with our soul the Lord undertakes to address when he has our attention through the medium of suffering. If sin is the loser, then grace in the soul is the winner. Sin's defeat is the victory of holiness and our being made conformed to the image of his Son. Now, my final heading tonight. The grace of believing in eternity. The grace of believing in eternity. It's commonly said, isn't it, that the Lord needs always to be weaning us off attachment to this world to make us focus more on the world to come. And that is so true. Affliction makes us reevaluate our place in this world and our expectations. Are we too much at home here? Do we expect too much from this fallen world? Do we feel we're entitled to a trouble-free existence, and that anything less than that is a cause of great puzzlement and concern to us? There are a host of reasons why this, when you put it that way, flabbiness might set in. Compared to previous generations, we have here in the West relatively trouble-free environments. Our nation has enjoyed, relatively speaking, peace and prosperity. As I've already alluded, we have an excellent health service that, by and large, works with amazing medications and procedures that prolong our lives, reduce pain, and rectify a host of conditions that simply could not be cured in a bygone age. Political parties compete to manage our lives better, cushion us from economic harm, look after our bodies and the NHS more efficiently, and defend us from our nation's enemies, educate us better, and offer us more opportunities, and enable us then to take them up. Government offers itself as our protector and guardian, and people expect it to deliver. As Christians, we know better, don't we? We know this is a wicked world, a fallen world that follows in many places very wicked doctrines and very selfish ends. We know that death awaits us all unless the Lord returns in our lifetime. No government, however well-intentioned, can insulate us completely from all this. Yet we can begin to buy into the lie, I fear that is what it is, that we should be able to enjoy a trouble-free and risk-free life. Job, in the midst of his afflictions, gives one of the most stirring and triumphant accounts of this belief in the hereafter. Job 19, verses 25 to 27. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though, after my skin, worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself. Mine eyes shall behold, and not another, that my reins be consumed within me. It is orthodox belief and practice to actually place a greater premium on our well-being after we die than we do on our well-being here on earth. In other words, we are a heavenly-minded people, and it should show in how we talk about life and how we talk about death. John Calvin, again, is particularly good at bringing this point out. Here's a quotation from his Golden Booklet of the Christian Life. Golden Booklet of the Christian Life. Well, worth a read it is too. But in a section which is entitled, "We are inclined to overestimate this present life," he observes this, and I quote him. "We not only forget death, but the fact that we are mortals, as if no word concerning this has ever reached us. And we continue our foolish dream that we are to live forever. If any man in the meantime reminds us of the proverb that man is only a creature of a day, we are willing to acknowledge the truth, but with such lack of attention that the idea of a perpetual life keeps on lingering in our minds." How true his words, his day and our day. People think somehow they're meant to live forever in this present world, as though somehow technology, better government or something, will absorb all the risks, take away all the troubles, and we will live, if you like, forever. So our reflections are valuable in reminding us that that is a fiction. There is a better world, but it's not this world. It is the world to come. And the deepening of this realization is part of that sufficient grace that God gives to us in our affliction. Well, we've only scratched the surface. God's grace is multifaceted. Whatever the afflictions the Lord may send, know this, there will be sufficient grace to come through. If we at the moment are in the midst of such a shaking or a sifting, well, be attentive, be patient, be humble. The Lord may have some valuable lessons for us, as he did for Paul, with his thorn in the flesh.